Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. I want to remind everyone we're Zooming on Wednesday morning, so therefore if anything should happen Wednesday night at the Republican convention, we will not be discussing it. However, the other thing on top of everything else is that we have to remember that we begin every show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. Maybe one of the reasons why I'm really glad that we're discussing and bringing you the voice of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman is that he was and is an immigrant. He talks about that during his testimony. He assures his father that everything will be okay, that his father made the right decision to come to America. And of course, what we know is that it wasn't the right decision, perhaps, for Lieutenant Colonel Vindman and his brother because of what Donald Trump did. He eventually has left not only the employee of the White House, but he has retired early because of the harassment he experienced as a result of his testimony. One of the reasons why we share the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman is that we want his testimony ringing in your ears when you exercise the franchise in November of 2020. Now, Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So I went to slate.com, and we haven't talked to Jeremy Saul for a while, so I thought, you know, let's grab him. But in part, I wanted to grab him because he wrote a piece which was about my absolute favorite congressperson, and that is Katie Porter. The two pieces, Jeremy, that you wrote at slate.com, so he's a senior editor at Slate. The first one from a couple of days before was entitled, "The Prosecution Rests Without Kamala Harris. Senate Democrats Struggle to Pin Down Trump's Postmaster." And that was sort of the disappointing article, Jeremy. And then you wrote the second piece based on the House interrogation, which is exactly what Katie Porter did. Watch Louis DeJoy admit he doesn't know the price of a postcard. Representative Katie Porter's interrogation got more damning from there. So let me welcome you to the program, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well, Arnie. How are you?
I'm good. So let me just share something. I tweeted out your story from slate.com about Katie Porter. But as I tweeted out your story, I added a retweet, and this was my retweet. The best comment about the brilliance of Katie Porter's questioning of Postmaster General DeJoy, and it was a comment at slate.com. I just wish the other 85% of politicians didn't delude themselves into thinking that pontification is the same as investigation. That line should be given to every member of Congress and remind them why they are there. This is not about their soapbox. This is about investigating the person before them. And what I so adore about Katie Porter is that she not only gets it, she even warned DeJoy, "I am ready. I hope you are."
And the thing about Representative Katie Porter and her questioning here, a couple things. One, she's known for this. She's been known for this for a very long time. She's has a place on the Financial Services Committee where she's interrogated the CEOs of Wells Fargo and the CEO of J.P. Morgan and really put them in hard places. At the start of the pandemic, she interrogated Redfield, the chief of the CDC, and put him in a tough position to spell out exactly how much a cost of a coronavirus test was at that time and how it was not being covered by the government yet and how he had the authority to do that. And she put him in a position where he was in a corner and had to promise going forward that that testing would be covered for every American. And then on Monday in the hearing with the Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, she started it out with this very simple series of questions. How much does a postcard cost? How much is the starting rate for priority mail? And he said he didn't know, but then he said something like he acknowledges and accedes to the fact that this is not his area of expertise, or something a little bit, you know, sarcastic and kind of trying to brush it aside. But Katie Porter, another questioner doing that, it might have looked like grandstanding, which, as you just described, is not atypical during these hearings. But she was making a very targeted and precise point. It furthered the rest of her questioning, is what I'll say. And the point was that this guy has no business in his current job.
Well, what I love about her is, again, it's almost like DeJoy, while he said yes, which was interesting that he would appear before the House and the Senate, and that was important. Everyone already was sort of informed the fact that he was there because he was a huge donor to Donald Trump. He was there because he had no experience with the post office. He was there because Donald Trump, while technically Donald Trump doesn't appoint him as postmaster, he appointed the people that would eventually appoint the postmaster. And they were actually groomed to pick DeJoy. They were informed to pick DeJoy. So while it wasn't a direct appointment, it was definitely an indirect appointment. And Donald Trump knew exactly what the result was going to be, which was someone who was going to dismantle the post office. And I think the other thing that was so interesting is she started out with the small questions. She warned him ahead of time, Jeremy, that she was going to be ready for him. And you would have thought, if nothing else, he would have had the basics in front of him on a postcard. It's not like he couldn't have been prepared. It's not like someone couldn't have given him some of the basics, since he technically didn't know anything and he could have quickly been informed about this. But more importantly, he has conflicts of interest. So on every way you sort of slice this piece of pie, there's something rotten at the center.
Even putting aside the $3 million that he's donated to, you know, the cause of the Republican Party over the last years. And even putting aside the fact that, Louis DeJoy's personal donations to the cause of the Republican Party and Trump's Republican Party, that number in the millions of dollars, and putting aside that the Board of Governors, the chair of the Board of Governors who appointed him, also was a major Trump donor and bundler. Putting all of that aside, he has other major conflicts of interest that are ongoing towards this job. And those conflicts of interest include vested financial stakes in his former logistics company that still does business with the Postal Service, and stock options in Amazon.com. And Katie Porter very directly confronted him with the facts of these conflicts of interest. She confronted him with the fact that there is an internal investigation looking into those conflicts and whether or not they are problematic in any way. And she said directly to him, if the inspector general finds these to be misconduct, will you step down? And he would not commit to that. He would not commit to abiding by the ruling of an independent investigation into his own conduct. And he said there was nothing he could conceive of that had come up in the entire hearing as questionable in his actions as anything that he had done that might cause him to resign. Basically, he considers himself above any sort of oversight.
Well, let me just say something. What could also happen is Donald Trump could remove the investigative general. I mean, unfortunately, that's what we've seen. The pattern and practice is someone gets investigated and then the person who's doing the investigation is removed by the president. So, I mean, in a lot of ways, Jeremy is not stupid. He's seen the other pattern and practice by Donald Trump and he knows that his butt is covered, which is just so incredibly unfortunate. Can I just ask a quick question? No one has answered this for me. Explain to me what the conflict of interest is with the logistics company that he still is associated with and the USPS. What is that connection? I mean, I kind of have a little bit of an idea of the Amazon.com and the stock options, because Amazon.com does in fact use the Postal Service, especially for rural areas for delivery purposes. And Donald Trump is so angry that they worked out a deal with the Postal Service. But what about the logistics company? What exactly is that conflict?
So the logistics company is called XPO Logistics, and it was a previous company that he had started that was purchased by another company, and he was put on the board of directors of the you know, parent company after the purchase. He still retains a stake of $30 million in this company. Okay. The company contracts with you, USPS. The agency that he now is in charge of, basically USPS.
Okay.
So it's a direct and clear and obvious conflict of interest.
I'm just kind of curious about that, because I just don't understand. The other thing is that did the Postmaster General, when he was being pressed by Katie, and I just want everyone to know that included in your article is the testimony of Katie Porter and the questioning of Katie Porter and the Postmaster General. That will be put up on Facebook. So people, really, it's what, how many minutes? It's not that long. Watch it. Watch it from the beginning to the end, and then take notes, because she's got the best skill set of anyone I know. Because if nothing else, you want to do that with your children on occasion. It's like, you know, don't get emotional. Just keep asking the questions and get an answer. So one of the things that I know she asks is like, you know, you have dismantled things, you have done certain things, and his answer is always either no, I didn't, or they're still getting overtime. He's never specific, because the fact that maybe one person gets overtime means that maybe 99% of the people still don't get overtime. The fact that something was, you know, dismantled or disconnected, he basically said that he would not reconnect anything. Was there any reason as to, did she sort of, was there a follow-up during the course of those hearings about why won't you reconnect it? If the sorting machine is still there and all you did was unplug it, why aren't you reconnecting? And what's the point, especially if you want to make sure that there's an integrity of the vote in November?
There was a focus on a number of these things. And I would say overall, this House hearing, partially because there were just more questioners who were interested in getting to the answer of things than in the previous week's Senate hearing, was a bit more effective in at least demonstrating that the vagueness with which he was responding to everything and his inability to guarantee any specific rollback of the changes that he's already implemented. Right after Porter, actually, Mike Quigley questioned the Postmaster General and asked him about this overtime, the overtime cuts that had been reported in the Washington Post in a series of memos and documents, but that he denies is taking place at all. He outright denies it's taking place. And Quigley asked him, are you certain that they're not cutting back on overtime? And he said the direction was given to stop cutting back on overtime in postal retail centers. So that, and then a moment later, he said there was no directive to reduce overtime anywhere within the organization. So one second he's saying, we told them to stop cutting back the overtime. And then in another breath, he's saying, oh, we never told them to cut back the overtime. His testimony was full of these sort of series of contradictions that allowed him basically continue whatever line it is that he wants in a given moment without any sort of actual response.
So Jeremy, we've actually been following this USPS story for a while, and we did this really interesting interview about maybe a month and a half ago with a reporter from ProPublica. This is before the appointment of the Postmaster General. And it was really depressing. Let me just tell you something. It was a really depressing article. I think the guy's name was Ryan McCarthy at ProPublica, and I recommend that you go check his piece out. This was a story of having sort of for a year been going into the USPS offices around the country and talking to people who've been doing vote by mail and yada, 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 going to Colorado. So he would get a handle on what the states that have already had a history of voting by mail were experiencing. But one of the things he realized was there really is a problem with the United States Postal Service before the Postmaster General. They'd already been shutting down some sorting machines, that the states like Colorado and Oregon and whatever, that they actually go into these postal facilities and they do sweeps, because even under the current situation, before the postmaster started dismantling it and making it that much worse, they would find bags of, you know, envelopes with votes in them. And they had worked at a routine where they would literally go into these huge warehouses and completely examine every single box to find if they could find any more ballots. And that was before DeJoy. That was before DeJoy. And that's what I think is just so frightening is that what we don't know is that the system was sort of weakened ahead of time. And a lot of the states that had been voting by mail understood how weakened the system was and had developed a muscle, and they were prepared to vote by mail because they understood the situation they were handed. Imagine what it's like now for all the states that have never done this, at least to the level that we're looking at today. And then you look at what DeJoy has done by removing so many of the sorting machines all over the country, especially in blue states.
We've been saying specifically election expert Richard Hassan of UC Irvine, which is, I think it's actually Katie Porter's district, funnily enough, but he's been saying since March and April in Slate that this needs to be funded. Mail-in vote, and this again, you're right, this was before, this was before DeJoy was appointed. Mail-in voting is going to be so crucial to this upcoming election because it's going to be conducted in the midst of a pandemic, because the coronavirus pandemic has not been brought under control. And we've known this for months, as you noted in that ProPublica article. Those sort of difficulties with mail-in voting have continued and actually gotten worse since the pandemic started. Before DeJoy's policies were implemented in around June, the New York primary had this sort of disastrous outcome where many tens of thousands of ballots just didn't get mailed on time. This again was before the implementation of a lot of these changes. I think he was already Postmaster General at the time, but it was before the implementation of these changes. So these are ongoing problems that are being made worse at the worst possible time.
People yell at me and saying, Arnie, you shouldn't be talking about this. You know, we want to maintain the integrity of vote. We want to encourage people to vote by mail. And I'm thinking, in a lot of ways, this is designed exactly for what Donald Trump wants. Because if we're all going into this thin tunnel called the post office or voting by mail, then if you clog the tunnel or if you blow up the tunnel, guess what? You don't get a result. As you just pointed out, we saw that in New York weeks before they could actually get a result. And now we're talking about 50 states and the territories and the military and people overseas all voting at the same time. And just imagine the sort of cataclysmic events. And then when you find out, some people are saying, okay, we're going to relieve the pressure of the postal service and put these drop boxes in instead of the post box, so you won't even have to go to the postal service. Then Donald Trump is threatening to sue or suing states that are putting in drop boxes. I mean, it is a whack-a-mole here. And that is what is so scary. But I think we have to be with eyes wide open to understand what existed before the postmaster, to understand how it is even, it's like a synergistic effect. It is much worse today by what he did, given the situation it was before he even started.
It is a whack-a-mole. And I think that's why what was a very powerful and one of the most important messages of last week's Democratic National Convention, I believe it was Michelle Obama, who said directly, I think it was her, who said directly, make a plan to vote. Make a voting plan, whether it's returning your mail-in ballot early by mail, as early as possible, or finding one of these drop boxes, or having a plan to protect yourself and go on election day. Mm-hmm. Make a plan in advance, because of all the effort that's being made to make it so difficult. You have to plan this out very, very carefully.
And I live in a relatively rural state. I mean, I don't live in a rural area. I live in a small city. But one of the things I want to remind people is we don't have early voting. So, for example, in Texas, they've actually extended early voting, which is a good thing. They're not going to embrace mail-in voting, but they're going to have an extension of early voting because of COVID, I think, by an extra week. So that means that people can start voting 3 weeks before the election. So, you know, get your butt in gear, start figuring out. You don't want to wait for the last day or the last 2 days or whatever. You can start voting 3 weeks ahead of time. In New Hampshire, for example, we have expanded mail-in voting for absentee voting. We don't have mail-in voting, we have absentee voting. But for the purposes of absentee now, COVID-19 is considered a disability. Okay, Jeremy? That means I am now physically disabled. I don't get one of those little plaques in my car, but for the purposes of mail-in voting, I am now physically disabled. I have the vote. I have my little envelope sitting right here on my desk. I have another option. You know what the other option is? And I want to go back to what Michelle said, and it was Michelle Obama. And that is, I can hand deliver my mail-in ballot to the town clerk. You can do that with the city clerk. So you actually have, and isn't it interesting? It's kind of an early voting option. It doesn't have to go into a drop box. It doesn't have to go into a post box. If you're passing by the town clerk or the city clerk, you can hand deliver it. So again, there are so many options. I think that's the service that I think I need to provide, is to give people all the legal ways they can vote in their state. Because there's a lot of options here, and a lot of options could avoid the Postal Service and can also avoid the idea that there might be a delay.
And you're absolutely right. It's different everywhere. I believe Ohio has a similar situation where you can deliver personally to the county clerk. That's the only place you can deliver, but you can deliver there.
Right.
And there are different rules at different states.
Exactly.
And just the issue and the difficulty is that we don't know what Election Day is going to look like. We do not know how many volunteers are going to be available. We do not know what the situation with COVID-19 is going to be. There is no way right now to predict. It's impossible to predict what that situation is going to look like for people's safety, for your own safety. If there is an early voting option and you intend to vote, that is likely going to be the best way to do it.
Exactly. And I think every one of us, people like me, have a moral obligation to give people all the choices, explain to them what is legal, let them know what they can do, let them know when they can start voting, let them know how they can vote. And you're absolutely right. It is geographically specific, everyone. It is geographically specific. So what I say in Concord, New Hampshire, ain't going to work in like upstate Michigan, I'm just telling you. But that doesn't mean that you don't have lots of options as well. Before I let you go, though, Jeremy, I do want to touch on the original story that I saw as well as Slate. And it was really depressing to me. And you wrote, "The prosecution rests. Without Kamala Harris, Senate Democrats struggle to pin down Trump's postmaster." And we know that the Republicans control the Senate. So therefore, they're going to be in the driver's seat when it comes to questioning DeJoy. But there should have been some senators on that committee as well that would understand that they were there to interrogate and not to pontificate. But apparently the only senator in that committee that really sort of has understood that is Kamala Harris. And because she had just been nominated as the VP, she didn't show up. Why?
There are a couple things that I would say. I would just say that for the most part, I absolutely agree. And I wanted to convey in that article that there was a lot of empty grandstanding. Senator Jackie Rosen of Nevada actually did a very good job of pressing DeJoy on this question of whether or not he was going to turn over evidence and turn over data and turn over the plan and decision-making process that he used to make these changes. Mm-hmm. And she couldn't get him to acknowledge that he would do that, but that's because on the Senate, they don't have any subpoena power in the minority, the Democrats. But to your other point, Senator Harris had the night before been in Delaware with Vice President Joe Biden as he accepted the Democratic nomination. Now, this was done entirely over Zoom, so she could have been there. There's nothing stopping her. There was nothing physically stopping her from attending this hearing. There was no campaign event or anything like that that was publicized that was preventing her from doing it. Historically, Senate Democrats or Senate Republicans, whichever, if you're put on the ticket, you generally step away from those duties. That's the history of this. That's the precedent of this. My sense is that the campaign did not want to turn attention to Senator Harris in a way that might receive some kind of blowback in conservative media or generally for potentially, say, breaking with that precedent, or just using her position on the committee to
grandstand.
Even if she was asking important questions, to appear to be advancing the political campaign via her position on the committee, even though we saw yesterday with all the Hatch Act violations that occurred during the second night of the Republican National Convention, from Mike Pompeo's speech in Jerusalem to the White House Rose Garden speech of Melania Trump, that really there is nothing, no part of that office and no part of that power that this administration and this president will not use to try to advance his political interest. And in fact, that is the entire purpose of that office for them.
Jeremy, I love you. You're so articulate and you explain things well. And I feel like every time I get done with an interview with you, I have all these like points that I need to make sure I make again and make again. But let me just say something else. We do know that Kamala did offer a series of questions that she wanted answered by DeJoy. What I would have loved to have seen is one of the Democratic senators to put their ego to the back of the bus and take every one of the questions that Kamala had asked and said, "This is what Kamala would have asked you if she were here," and go 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm going to suspend my questions and use hers. If nothing else, it reinforces how she thinks. It reinforces the sort of prosecutorial mind that she has. And in some ways, it elevated her because even though she wasn't there, because she understood that was historically what you didn't do, and she still wanted to believe there were still some norms despite Donald Trump, but then her voice and her message could still have been carried.
From what I know, some of those questions were asked, and I believe even offered to some other of the Senate Democrats on the panel. But what Senator Harris really brings to the table, beyond very precise and very direct and very legalistic questions is just the ability to ask pointed and critical follow-up questions. As right. as having been a district attorney in San Francisco, yes. an attorney general in California, this past as a prosecutor, as much as it's almost been a point of contention and a point of challenge among progressives for her, it is actually yeah. very, very helpful.
A great skill set. It's a great skill set.
It's a very, totally. And it's one she has in spades in terms of the ability to bring very a hard line of questioning to the table.
I could keep you on for 2 hours. We're having a conversation with Slate senior editor Jeremy Stahl. He wrote two pieces, Watch Louis DeJoy Admit He Doesn't Know the Price of a Postcard. Woo! And the other one, The Prosecution Rests Without Kamala Harris. Senate Democrats Struggle to Pin Down Trump's Postmaster. We will grab you again. I missed you, Mr. Stahl. Thank you so much
Thank
for joining
so much,
us.
Jeremy.
I really appreciate it. All right.
Thank you.
You're welcome. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1921. That was the day that the Green Bay Packers football team received a charter from the American Professional Football Association. A year later, this would become the National Football League. The Green Bay Club had started up 2 years earlier. Its original sponsor was the Indian Packing Company in Green Bay, Wisconsin. They packaged canned meat. Meat packaging was a major industry in the Midwest during this era. Packing plants in Chicago, Kansas City, Iowa, and Wisconsin processed the cattle and pigs raised in the West as meat to feed the nation. Curly Lambeau was a shipping clerk for the company. He helped to organize a group of local players into a football team. Curly persuaded his boss to donate money for the uniforms. And it was there that the name Packers was born. When the Indian Packing Company fell on hard times, they were bought out by Acme, another packing company based in Chicago. So, for a brief moment, the Green Bay Packers, one of the staunchest rivals of the Chicago Bears, was actually owned by a Chicago company. Although Acme only owned the team for 1 year, the team nickname stuck. Lambeau was able to buy the team back. He went on to become the Packers coach, leading them to 6 championships. The Green Bay Packers are not the only American sports franchise that's name harkens back to a particular kind of labor. Another Wisconsin team, the Milwaukee Brewers baseball team, is a reference to that city's proud beer brewing tradition. In Big Ten sports, the Purdue Boilermakers and Nebraska Cornhuskers take to the gridiron each week with names that reflect the working traditions of the cities where the teams play ball. Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
Distance.
Welcome back to part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. I want to remind everyone that we're Zooming on Wednesday, so we will not be sharing anything from Wednesday night's GOP convention, actually Trump convention. I work with a publicist, and the publicist said to me, "You're going to be covering the Republican convention, aren't you?" I said, "Of course." He said, "I've got this book that might be actually totally appropriate during the Republican convention." I go, "You got a book?" He goes, "Yeah, I got a book." And I got the little book right in my hand right here, and it's entitled White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. And I went, oh, you know, I think that book might have something to do with the Republican Party and white supremacy and, you know, the control of the evangelicals and everything else. I said, I think I would like to interview this author. I grabbed an article about our author, and I want to sort of just grab it really quickly and introduce you to her. Her name is Professor Kyati Joshi. She is a professor of education at Fairleigh Dickinson University. She explores Christian privilege. This is what the article says. Christian privilege, Christian normativity, Christian hegemony, in this powerful analysis, her book, White Christian Privilege. But this is the part that I think is the most operative. Her argument is simple. Christianity, particularly the European Protestant strain, has been established as the unacknowledged common culture, not simply religion of the United States, leading to a situation where anything not white, Western, and Christian is seen as abnormal. So let me welcome Professor Joshi to the program. Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. And your book is incredibly timely and very appropriate for this week.
Thank you for having me, Arnie. Yes, it is. Unfortunately, I would say.
Exactly. I was a religion major in college. I was on my way to divinity school. Okay, I applied to Harvard D School, I applied to Vandy, applied to a couple of Union Theological, and I decided not to go. But one of the reasons I decided not to go might have actually been inspired from what happened when I was in high school, and I was studying sort of, you know, we go to after school Christian schools and whatever, and I was a Protestant. And at one point, I remember I had a big fight with my minister. And the big fight with my minister was when he said, you know, if you believe in me, you shall attain eternal life. That if, you know, the idea that if you didn't believe in Jesus Christ, that you weren't going to go to heaven. If you didn't believe in Jesus Christ, you wouldn't be saved. And I grew up in a Jewish Italian neighborhood, and some of my friends were Muslim. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, what about them? That was when I began to realize, is this what I want to do? Because I wasn't sure that there was one path to God. I wasn't sure that I'd cornered the market on virtue. And yet, that's what I was being sold, all right? And I knew at age 17, and I'm 66 now, Professor Joshi. So I even knew then that it was not comfortable for me. But yet, you wrote a book that said, unfortunately, it's not only that it's comfortable with a lot of people, it's kind of defined who we are.
Yes, and you know, I identify, for your listeners to know, I'm Indian American. I was born in India, raised in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm a Hindu. And I actually went to theology school. And I think the joke was, is I had to have been the only Hindu in seminary, you know. So I've been very interested. I also was a religion major. I think the thing is that we have been led to believe from the time we were in first grade that this country was founded upon the ideals of religious freedom. And the truth is that the Puritans came here seeking religious haven, right? Seeking a haven from persecution. But they were in it for themselves, Arnie. They weren't looking for religious freedom for everybody. So that myth that has been told to us from a very young age really guides how we see this country. And when we look at the history, we look at our laws, we look at the impact of laws, you can see the very strong Christian foundation that's there. And the thing is that it's actually not, we can't just examine Christianity. It's really looking at how whiteness and Christianity are kind of entwined together to create the society we have today.
We talk a lot about the original documents, about the idea of separation of church and state, about that all men are created equal. And I've told this story before. John Nichols of The Nation magazine does something really remarkable. And it reminded me, as I was reading your book, that this was something that it's about what our ideals are and yet how we haven't gotten there. Sort of, it's sort of like it's in the distance and we know what's right. We just haven't quite achieved it yet. And he does something where he has everybody in a room stand up. Professor Joshi. And then he says to everyone in the room, he goes, okay, I want all the women to sit down. And then he says, I want everyone under the age of 21 to sit down. And then I want everyone that rents to sit down. And then I want everyone of color to sit down. And he goes to this laundry list of people. And then what's left standing is a bunch of old white men. Okay, and usually it's like 12 in the room. And he goes, that's the only people that could exercise the franchise when we first began. All right. Remember we said all men are equal, but that was a lie. But that was the ideal. And so I think you are right about the idea that we look at what's on paper and we think we actually live the ideal. We don't actually deal with the reality that we do exactly the opposite, that we've never really achieved it. But it also means that we actually have a backstop called that piece of paper that says there is a separation of church and state, that we should recognize that, you know, any person of faith or not faith is on the same footing and there shouldn't be a privilege. But in fact, we haven't gotten there yet.
Right. And because we aren't able to see reality, I mean, that's why in the book I talk about the idea of all of this being an optical illusion, the idea of religious freedom being an optical illusion. Because what does an optical illusion do? It prevents you from seeing what's right in front of you. Okay.
Exactly.
So we think it's on paper that we have a legal mandate for freedom of religion. Therefore, we think it's reality. But we have this optical illusion because we're not seeing really what's in front of us. The other thing an optical illusion does is it distorts what you're seeing, right? And so you think you're seeing something else. So we think we have religious freedom. We think we're seeing religious freedom, but we're really not. And that's shown out by a variety of things. Not all Jewish communities, Hindu communities, Sikh communities, Muslim communities have been able to build a house of worship. Across this land, there's been opposition for various houses of worship going up, right? If we really had religious freedom, that wouldn't happen. Our starting point is not neutrality. Our starting point is a white Christian supremacist culture.
Right.
And if we can see that, then we can see all the places we have, you know, where all the things we have to kind of remedy. I mean, we've got to be able to see the injustice to get to justice.
I use this fact a lot, and it's a good fact, but you're absolutely right. There probably still is this illusion. And that is that America has more places of worship per person than any country in the world. So that reinforces the idea that this was a place where you come to celebrate your faith. That doesn't mean that there aren't places of worship. It means that maybe there's still a sort of a hierarchy of power. So you can be a Muslim, you can be a Jew, you can be a Hindu, you can be Baha'i. And yes, you can have your place of worship, but who controls ultimately the outcome? Who is actually invested in the power? Who ultimately
yes.
is sort of in charge? And especially on the Republican side, what we have seen is that the evangelicals now have been incredibly successful in taking over the Republican Party.
Yeah. And you know, Arnie, the distinction we make and has to be made is between the presence of religious diversity and the presence of religious freedom and social justice, right?
Oh, that's a great point. That's a great time, to say that.
And we often think that because we have the presence of diversity, that we have the presence of equity and justice. And that's not the case. So that's what we have to see, that diversity and pluralism doesn't automatically mean that everyone has a seat at the table or that everyone's voice is being heard in an equitable way.
Do you see, your book is about the idea of, let me describe this, the title again is White Christian Privilege. Do you think that that is beginning to erode? That what we are seeing is, as we're seeing a more diverse nation, as America is browning, as we're beginning to see, I look at the story of gay marriage. I mean, if you are an evangelical Christian, that and abortion are the two things you absolutely, you know, it's the Antichrist. And yet now look at what has happened. We went from a place where a number of states made it absolutely illegal to ever even consider marriage between a man and a man, a female and a female, to the point where now it is the law of the land. I mean, that it happened in such a short period of time to me is mind-blowing. I was hoping before I die that that would be the case, and now it's the reality. I am looking what is happening as a result of Black Lives Matter. And Black Lives Matter, and because we now have the video and the tape, they've known forever, they've lived it forever, they have the talk with their sons, but until we actually saw someone's knee on someone's neck, we didn't realize that it was something that was just as horrific as we've been told in the past. So I am just wondering if this white Christian privilege is also going to be eroding, because we're going to be peeling the scabs off our eyes and realizing that we want more than diversity. We want religious freedom.
Yeah, I think we will start seeing a change. I think what's also important to understand is that white privilege and Christian privilege and white Christian privilege has been embedded into our laws and court decisions for the last 300 odd years, right? That's not going to dissipate in a year or two, right? I know that often segments of the evangelical community, the white evangelical community in particular, will often use the idea of religious freedom as a rallying cry because they feel like their religious freedom is being trampled upon when marriage equality becomes law of the land with the 2015 Supreme Court decision, Obergefell v. Hodges, right? So they feel like they're being discriminated against. And what I would say to them is just look at 300 plus years of our laws. You got a lot of stuff going for you. Right. And that's not eroding. You just think it is.
So what I think is important, there's a wonderful book by Norm Rothstein, I think that's his name, called The Color of Law. And The Color of Law is, it's a brilliant book. I'm just going to recommend that you read this book and you read that book. And you actually read them together. In some ways, they'll make you want to punch out a wall.
But yeah.
Right. And so have you, as you talk about this, so you equate whiteness and religion as almost, to some extent, they've been sort of bled together. So we know from the book, The Color of Law, that a lot of the policies we've written have had incredibly negative effects about people of color. Have you been able to go through those laws and be able to sort of tie it to faith as well? And I'm looking at, and I think that would be really fascinating, is to be able to just show people. And I know, for example, when you're talking about things like healthcare policy, we know that it goes through the lens of the evangelical community. We've seen it over and over again. And I think it would be really useful, too, for people to understand this is an overlay, but the overlay is really about this white evangelical Christian take on what is policy for all of us.
Right. So there's two things there that there's two things you said that I want to comment on. First of all, I actually provide a historical overview on how whiteness and Christianity have gone together. And I'm going to give you a quick example of something from a while back, but it still affects us today. I'm going to pick out the Immigration Act of 1917 and the Immigration Act of 1924. For your listeners to think about. The Immigration Act of 1917 was passed during a time where we were in very, you know, pro-America, anti-immigrants time of our country in 1917. And it said, it basically barred people coming to the United States, immigrating to the United States from a large chunk of Asia, okay? The law says nothing about religion, Arnie, but when you look at the religious groups who are impacted by that, it's many non-Protestant groups,
right.
Jews, Hindus, Muslims, so on. Mm-hmm. In 1924, Congress passed the Johnson-Reed Immigration Bill that limited immigration to the United States from Southern and Eastern Europe, all right? When you look at those sending countries and you look at the majority religious background of those peoples, it was Catholic, Jewish, and Eastern Orthodox, okay, mm-hmm. Christian. So just to give you a snapshot of 1917 plus 1924, we were using immigration policy to socially engineer a white Protestant country. Right. And our immigration law didn't change. We didn't open our doors again until 1965. Now, there were a few exceptions along the way, not nearly enough, because we didn't take in nearly enough Holocaust refugees as we should have. Okay, but that just gives you a little bit of a snapshot on how we see race and religion going together, and how those two laws that I brought up say nothing about religion, but you have to look at the impact.
Right. It's code. When I ran for governor in 1992, no, actually it's Congress. Both times I was accused of it. But in 1996, I'm running for Congress, and the guy that's running against me is telling everyone you can't trust me. And the reason you can't trust me is that I have New York values. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now I'm in New Hampshire, and every Jew knows what that means. New York values is code for Jew. Okay. It's unbelievable. And that was what was heard over and over again. I had dark hair. I was an attorney. I was aggressive. I was whatever. And so therefore he could say New York values, and he never had to say that he was anti-Semitic, and that it was, and everybody knew. The Jews knew, and everybody else knew that that's what they were saying. So you're absolutely right. So they talk in code, but you have to look at the consequence.
Right. That's exactly it. And sometimes it isn't anti-Semitism that you're experiencing, but it is that the Christians have advantage, and that's the privilege piece. And yes. Privilege is a consequence. It's a product of systemic oppression. So the systemic racism that exists in America, produces white privilege. The systemic religious discrimination results in Christian privilege for Christians, right? Now, what you were experiencing there, it's pretty clear it was anti-Semitism, you know, yeah. but they're able to work in a different way, just as you said.
And it's so funny, because I think somehow all you got to do is tell people that, you know, you're not a Jew, and they're going to vote for you. No, they're going to come up with some other reason to do it, but they use all the ways to sort of marginalize the opposition. So because of their privilege, and whatever their privilege could be male, their privilege could be white, their privilege is because they were born here. It's all those things. And I think what is the threat here is that it's not just different faith. It isn't just different people of color. It's that they've controlled the bench, Professor Joshi.
Absolutely.
And when you control the bench, your whole goal is to make sure the bench is as small as possible and that you know exactly who the players are. And once you start expanding the bench, and the bench comes in with women, the bench comes in with people of color, the bench comes in with people with different ethnic and religious backgrounds, you're not in control anymore, because right. they've changed the terms of the game, because they bring different experiences to the table. They bring different views to the table. It's much easier when everyone is white like you, was raised like you, and believes religiously like you. You kind of know exactly how to fight them. You don't know how to deal with it. When there is this level of diversity, it makes it more challenging. And the last thing you want, if you want power, is to be challenged.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, the way that the RNC was opened with the, you know, invocation of Jesus. I mean, when that happens on a public stage, it is basically on purpose saying the rest of you don't matter. And we don't want you here. I mean, that's really how it's heard. You know, there are clergy associations that actually have guidelines for the interfaith groups they're involved in on, you know, if we're going to have an interfaith event, and if we're going to have prayer, then what should be the guidelines, you know, so that it is as inclusive as possible. In the book, I talk about a clergy association in Lynchburg, Virginia. That has that, you know, and so there are ways of doing this. We just can't see that the Christian, what we've seen is people saying, well, the Christian way is the normal way. And we have to, you know, we have to get away from that. And you brought up earlier issues that are important to the evangelical community in terms of abortion and gay rights, or not having gay rights. And one of the things I talk about in my book is that we have to start reframing the question. So why is it in our country that the moral issues of evangelical Christians get defined as America's moral issues? Because I think there are many of us who are of a variety of religious faiths and no faith at all, who see environmental justice as a moral issue, right? Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to start kind of, once we can see the white Christian foundation of this country, we can start changing things. And I think one of the things we've got to really think about is who gets to define what's moral for all of us in the United States.
Well, I've always talked about the fact that, you know, when I look at the national budget or I look at a state budget, that your budget is a moral document. And to talk about morality that way, but I feel like there are certain things that have been hijacked. You know, patriotism has been hijacked away from me. The flag has been hijacked away from me. Morality has been hijacked away from me. I resent it because I want to share it. I don't want to own it. I don't want it taken away. You know, they're not the only ones, as you point out, to define what is morality. From an evangelical perspective, I remember hearing Ralph Reed talk at the beginning of the early 1990s. And Ralph Reed was the head of the Christian Coalition, you know, the Moral Majority. And Ralph Reed basically said that within a decade or two, they were going to control 30 Republican sort of state parties of the 50 in the United States. They accomplished it sooner, and they actually controlled more than 30. They understood that not only were they going to, quote unquote, be in charge and define this white Christian privilege, but they were going to actually own a party. And the party that they realized they were going to own was the Republican Party. And what is so ironic about the election of Donald Trump, someone who is so a-religious, someone who is so immoral, someone who needs to be acquainted with the truth because he's never spoken the truth, someone who's gone through more marriages than most people go through, you know, different kinds of potato chips. I mean, right. This person now has become the definition of the white Christian privilege leadership. And in part, what's fascinating about him is that the way they sort of contort his inability to be ethical and moral is that they perceive him as their sinner.
Yeah.
They even own the sins. They don't just own the morality, they own the sins. And therefore, he is their sinner.
Right. Well, even all the way that that's discussed and the language that it's discussed. I mean, let's take Donald Trump for a second and actually think about the coverage that has been given to him. And let's just go back to earlier this summer when he took that stroll to St. John's Church and held
up the upside down Bible.
Right. Well, there's an issue that he did that, Arnie, but I'll tell you what the other issue is. The other issue is journalists and the media only talking about what he does in relation to evangelicals and how that his evangelical base, there's cracks and there's fissures because the communities of color who are evangelical may not be tuning in. I'm like, you know, there's also the Jews, there's also the Hindus and the Muslims and the unaffiliated. So there's what Donald Trump does, there's what his cronies and his followers do, and then it's also about how the media reports what's going on and where they decide to give oxygen. In one sense, so many journalists perpetuate white Christian privilege.
Exactly.
In terms of what's covered and not covered.
He's a master of defining the parameters of the conversation. And the media falls into that definition of the parameters of the conversation. We were just talking to a reporter from Slate.com, and we were talking about the fact that Kamala Harris wasn't at this hearing for Postmaster DeJoy. And what he said was her skill set isn't that she's a great prosecutor, that she knows how to ask great questions. Here's her real skill set. She knows great follow-up questions. And I think what I'm so disappointed with the media, is that I understand that Donald Trump is setting the parameters of the conversation. I know he's throwing out that shiny coin and they're going to follow that shiny coin. But what is never seems to happen is they don't get beyond it. So they get limited in that parameter and they don't go beyond and expand their lens. And that's right. Their obligation, because I know by now what he's doing. They right. should know by now what he's doing. Why the hell haven't they learned it?
Right. Right. No, I completely agree. And even when we see how, you know, members of the Republican Party are contorting themselves, I mean, Nikki Haley the other night, and I actually talk about Nikki Haley in my book, because when she was running in South Carolina, she converted to being a Methodist, you know, at some point in her early adulthood. But her campaign, Arnie, would receive emails like, is Nikki Haley a Christian? You know, what religious background is she? If she's not a Christian, I don't think she can represent me. So at one point they had on her website changed and said Nikki Haley is a Christian. Right. So this idea of these tests that you have to pass through, I mean, she at least does acknowledge her Sikh family and her parents and background, which is something Bobby Jindal, former governor of Louisiana, doesn't do. Right. I mean, we could have a whole show on him.
Well, we're gonna have to call you back, because there's so much more I want to talk about. But what inspired this conversation, especially the Republican convention, is that the totally appropriate book that we should be discussing during that convention is White Christian Privilege: The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. Professor Joshi is a professor of education at Fairleigh Dickinson University and explores Christian privilege. It was a privilege to actually have you on the air with me right now. I think this is a time of awakening. I am terrified about what's going to happen. I don't know whether we're going to have resolution or revolution after this election of 2020. But I think a lot of people, in part because of the pandemic, in part because of the grotesque inequality, in part because of Black Lives Matter, in part because of the upside down Bible, in part because of the abuse of the White House, I think a lot of people are recognizing that democracy is something that you have to work at, that there are things on paper that you really think are a reality and they're not. And your goal is to make those things of separation of church and state, that all men are created equal. It's a great idea. Now make it really happen. So thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
It was a pleasure. All right, everyone. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow. Take care. Ciao. You change.